Eugene, Parvone, and Eric in the office?
Yep, we're all here.
Sweet. Jeremy, just in case you don't remember, I think you've talked to Alex once. You're director of IT, right?
Yep.
And then we have Eric, who you've met, Pavan, who you've been interacting with, and Eugene, who is a new hire in IT. Okay?
Cool.
And Jeremy is our consultant for big data, for system engineering and big data. So let me preface this whole meeting. So during the holidays, Jeremy spent a number of hours reimaging all of our nodes in production. However, that was made on the assumption with a miscommunication that all those nodes would be Docker. So Jeremy took that assumption, ran with it, and made perfect Docker servers, which doesn't necessarily help us with what we're trying to do, which is we're trying to have Hadoop and Docker kind of live together. So that's my bad. I'll make sure to have better communication with our consultant moving forward. But from this point on, I think what would help all of us is to have IT, Alex's group, reimage those servers the way we need them, with the right profiles and all the tools we need. And Jeremy and Eric, you're basically here to kind of guide and provide input as to what we need and how we need to go about that. Okay?
Yeah, so just to add to you, the idea is that, and I guess that's somewhat of a question. So we want Docker and we want Hadoop, but we want it to run side by side, meaning Hadoop just runs on host OS and then running next to it.
So here's the vision, okay? The vision is to leverage some of the latest Docker networking abilities, and Jeremy actually has a lot more knowledge there than I do, but kind of make a swarm of containers that talk to each other, mm-hmm. but across hosts, not on a single host, right? And that would enable us to do clusters of Storm, clusters of Redis, clusters of whatever we need, and we're trying to be flexible in our nodes, even though you know the hardware is not exactly the same. The fact is, we are planning to deploy Hadoop, and then we're probably going to move some roles around, trying to figure out how to best use our hardware. And I want to be able to simply move containers or simply move roles using Cloud Data Manager. However, I want that to be easy for us to figure out, hey, we are over-utilizing that machine and we're under-utilizing that one, and we can actually adjust that. Which is why my vision was to have Cloud Data Agent and Docker on every machine. Now we can talk to that if anybody has any objection. Jeremy, Alex?
Well, I still have, so just to clarify, so Hadoop Cloud Data will be running by itself.
Yep.
It will not be running in Docker containers.
No.
And then Docker containers will be running whatever you guys want, Storm, something else,
yep.
on the same machines.
Yep.
Okay. So I guess the next question is, do you prefer to have like Hadoop and Cloud Data set up first?
That's probably a good idea.
At the same time.
Yeah, I think Cloud Data needs to be completely installed first. That way, whatever I have to work with isn't going to, you know, like you're finalized in your configuration, so I can do what I need to do around that. That would just make things a lot easier, I think.
All right. And again, this is something that you, Jeremy, or Eric basically can do. So one of the things that we want to achieve is kind of a two-step process of how those things would be set up. So we would build an image that is pretty vanilla, but is already accounting for anything in our infrastructure. So it's not just going to be a bare CentOS install when we don't have any tools, we don't have any configuration for common services. Like, the idea is we can provide that. So we get you to the point when you have the nodes that are not a network, they have names assigned, they have like NTP, for example, running and configured. They have monitoring tools like Zabbix running and configured, LDAP client, etc. So like all of that can be rolled in the image deploy that we would do. And you know, in addition to this, we can add things like Docker, because it doesn't again take much to just install it on the initial deploy. So configuration of Docker is something that, you know, you guys will be managing, meaning like how many containers you want, what containers, etc. Now there are two key elements to this that we need to know ahead of time. So one of them is the hard drive partitioning, because the nodes do have different hardware and different count of drives. Mm-hmm. So, you know, because you're going to be running Hadoop, I don't see any point in rating the data drives in any configuration. So this is kind of the change that we need to do on a RAID controller, when we just say all disks are just separate disks, or we will rate it, but I don't see the reason why I would rate it.
No.
So I don't know how well it will work for your containers, because if you will use all the disks for Hadoop, your containers still need to access data that lives somewhere. So that's the question number one. And again, we don't have to answer these questions immediately. This is just to put it out there, and we can have a separate offline talk about it. The second question is about Docker containers and networking. So it's my understanding that you have basically some containers that are only intended to communicate to another containers within the cluster of machines. And then you'll have containers that would need to communicate, say, to production network. So we would need to figure out how to deal with that, so everything works in terms of communication, even between the nodes, since you know, the regular approach is that the containers, you know, will be having their own IP addresses that are internal to the host, and then the host itself basically NATs the request, which is not necessarily something that will work if you're trying to communicate externally to another host. But again, we don't have to solve this now. It's more of a
And there are solutions for that, but
So Swarm Docker Swarm should handle container to container communication, even across hosts. The thing that I'm not sure of, and what I've been telling Jan, is that I don't exactly know how it's going to work when a container has to communicate with a service running on the host operating system and vice versa. And that for me at least is something that has to be explored, you know, at the time of installation to figure out what's required at that level. 'Cause typically, you don't really do that with Docker containers.
Well, the only, so since we would be running a lot of the service in Docker, so be it Redis or MySQL, all those stuff, you know, there's a lot of it is going to be container to container. But that said, there will be stuff managed by the Cloud Era Manager, say Kafka, Zookeeper, HDFS, that will need to be accessed from the containers. And I know it's feasible. I've seen, you know, many recipes out there. Now, I don't guarantee that it's not hairy, okay? And that's, I'm sure it's gonna take a little bit of research.
Yeah, I mean, anything's possible, but it's not a, I don't think it's an out of the box thing.
No. No, probably not, but there's certainly like 17 different ways to get Docker to connect to a production cluster. So we'll just have to find the one that fits us, basically.
I think for Docker, it would be great to have at least 100 gigs in VAR for Docker containers, if that's possible.
Right. Well, I mean, again, I don't, this is not the call that tends to jump in the exact details, but the much more to just set up the a bit more of a process, and like all these details we can iron out as we go. But what sounds to me that, you know, should be happening as a first thing is that we basically reimage the nodes with anything that we need for just a generic config to make sure that they're online, they're monitored, etc. There's no DNS resolution issues, all of that good stuff. Step two is to set up Cloudera Hadoop cluster, and then that's where, you know, what we can do is, I'd say it can be done in parallel. We can take one node that you know can be used by Jeremy, for example, to test or, you know, all the different basically Docker configurations, so we can figure out networking. We can figure out how much disk space Docker needs. It's copy and write file system, so it probably needs a lot. Especially the containers live for a long time. Mm-hmm. So that can be done, you know, it doesn't have to be done on all the nodes. It can be done on one node to test, maybe two, to test inter-node communication. And in the meantime, you know, Hadoop part can be set up. It's a separate install. So, and again, this is all up to,
And all that can work. I want to start at the beginning real quick. So the reimaging part, Jeremy, do you have any issue with having the Docker engine just be there part of the image?
No, that sounds good.
Okay.
Saves a step.
Okay, then
I just don't think I should start any configuration until CDH is installed and up and running in exactly the way that you guys want it to be installed.
And that's, again, as Alex said, and we all agree, that's step two, and that's going to be Eric's is going to set that up and make sure everything talks to each other, all the Kafka zookeeper, everything is set up correctly. But that said, Alex had a very good point. We are planning on having three nodes that are completely dedicated to Docker. And those three nodes can be easily used by you to figure out the couple of things we need to figure out.
Yeah, that's fine.
So you probably don't need to wait for Hadoop to be completely available to actually get started. You can play with three nodes, come up with the configuration you need, and then we can even, I don't know if that's feasible, we can...
Well, I mean, I'm not going to be able to test that communication with Hadoop until
not with
Hadoop is installed.
But, you know, like, we can probably set up, like, a, you know, some kind of external service for you to hit, or just do a simple, you know, curl on yahoo.com, like, make sure it hits the production network, something.
Yeah. Well, one caveat to this is that I think that your final goal is to run things side by side, meaning Docker containers and Hadoop. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Yeah, hitting external URLs is not something I'm worried about, or external services. It's hitting services that are running on the same machine as the Docker daemon.
Right. So you know, the you can do some initial setup and, you know, in terms of setting up your containers, you know, preparing the container images effectively in parallel, but then you would basically need to test the connectivity. So we can kind of set this as a offline discussion. Yeah. I would really want also, like, the, for all these things, especially like disk config, etc., even though, like, we seem to be on the same page that we're not going to do RAID, for example, for data disks, I think it would definitely help just to have a quick spec, a very summarized spec of, like, you know, what we need, so we just don't have to go back and forth a lot of times. We'll do it once, we'll have that spec, we'll have images and a kickstart configured, and you know, as we go forward, we will be able to update that part if we change something, you know, we say edit more nodes and we want to provision them again. So we will gain this reusable code that we can just use to make more nodes. We provision existing nodes, mm-hmm. And just keep iterating, but with the kind of same process in mind, so we never run into a situation of don't know what to do.
Yeah, so Robin created he dumped out the hardware or the RAID configuration for the nodes, and I was going to go through that list and come up with the configurations for each of those nodes that I think should be done with them, and then we can discuss if they need to be changed, and then that way we'll at least have the groundwork for how, like, what the images will look like or how many different images will need, mm-hmm. Different configurations. So that'll kind of be my next.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think at this point, I think we all agree that it's simpler to just reimage all the servers with the right configurations, right?
Yeah. Yep. And I think that also allows us not to worry about any further reimaging if it needs to be done or extra nodes that need to be added. We'll have everything ready to go.
Okay.
Yeah, that way too. If we lose a host, it should be a lot easier and quicker just to bring it back up with just a fresh image and.
Yep.
You know, that kind of thing. So,
okay. So, I'll make. I'm gonna try to make some notes here and send a summary for that. But basically, here's what I'm hearing. I'm just gonna recap quickly for everybody. First step, Eric is gonna come up for different profiles for each node, different configuration profiles. Then we're going to create images and deploy those images, right? And that's gonna be IT. And that's going to include the Docker engine. Then Eric is going to install Hadoop on all the nodes, the CDH agent, and start working on deploying Kafka, Zookeeper, and all that stuff, and HDFS. At that point, Jeremy can probably start playing with those three Docker nodes that are dedicated to Docker, see if he can connect to Kafka or to HDFS or whatnot from there. And from a very high level, sounds like that's kind of the plan.
Yep.
Okay. So what I'll do is, anybody else has anything they want to add to this?
Nope.
Jeremy?
No, that sounds good.
Okay. So I'll create an email to recap all this that I just said, and I'll forward it to everybody just to start a thread, and if let's get moving forward.
Cool. Sounds good. Thanks.
Thank you.
Cool. All right. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Bye. Bye.
Cheers.
I just like to stay in that victim mode. And what I try, how I try to work around that is, from an astrological perspective, I really try to educate them and tell them this is just energy and potential, and it can be changed. You're not doomed. So I try to give them a little bit of an educational, but then I also go into that victimhood and try to explore what are the benefits of staying a victim? What are you getting out of that? And that's kind of where we start working. Are you getting extra attention? What exactly are you getting out of staying in that place? And try to help the clients see that they're in that place and see if they want to change and bring them out. And then we can work on other things. Because if the client stays in that victim and everything happens to me and I can't do anything, not even a counselor can do miracles. So it is a collaborative work that we have to do. So I try to pull the client into that collaboration.
Yeah, and that's a great way of doing it, Ileana, because you're right. Some people can get stuck in that victimhood, and then they make excuses for why their lives are not working, while they're not moving ahead, why they, you know, they're envisioning their perfect life, but they can't make it happen because everything is happening to them. And they're not taking the responsibility and the power. And you know, taking over their lives where they can and making the changes. So I love that you come from that perspective.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly it.
So what is one of the most interesting cases that you worked with that the combination really worked well?
Oh, there's several that come to mind, but one comes to mind that I had twins ask for an astrology chart, and these twins literally were born a minute apart from each other. And I did the chart, and I thought to myself, well, these charts are identical, which, you know, is true, but usually we know that even identical twins still have some difference in them. And I said, how am I going to differentiate those two twins from each other? So I took a very hard line approach when I calculated the chart. When nowadays we have computers, back mm-hmm. then I learned to do all the math, you know, by hand, and it was excruciating and long and took a long time. But there's some calculations that we do where we kind of, you know, we're not too strict. We kind of observe the chart in general and might give it a little one more point, minus a point, something like that. And with those twins, I was very, very strict. And what happened is one of the twins had one aspect in the chart that the other didn't. And that exact aspect, the meaning of that aspect was, I want to be different. So when they both came in, I asked who's who because they were, you know, exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And that one girl who had the aspect that showed, I want to be different, I told her, I said, my guess is that you're the twin that doesn't want to be a twin, that doesn't like to be a twin. And she was just like, her eyes turned that big, and she's like, that's exactly right. So I interpreted those charts from different filters. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And it's yeah. fascinating because it's only 1 minute apart.
Yeah.
And they in psychology and research, they love doing twin studies, especially identical twins. That's pretty rare. So that had been just a great learning tool for you to be working with. How often did you get to work with them?
It was just a one time. It was a chart that I did for them. So it was a one time, one session. That was it. But it turned out really great.
And wouldn't it be great if they came back to you and say, hey, do our charts again and see exactly if anything changed? I mean, that would be great. Hopefully they do
that
come back.
That would be amazing,
yeah. Yeah, that would be fantastic. So what are the strengths of doing the combination versus doing either one or the other?
The strengths in doing the combination is that I really see them as being very complementary. And if you think of a broader, I'm just going to go a little broader and then go more into detail. If you think from a broader perspective, in the old days, the sciences that we now call occult sciences and the mathematical and you know, hard four sciences, they were all one. Way back when, numerology and mathematics was one. We used numbers to do math, but they, each number had a meaning. Alchemy and chemistry was one science. It was just two sides from the same. Tarot and cards, playing cards and using the cards as a, you know, method of prediction. And so you can look at different, those two sides. Astrology and astronomy was one. Astronomy was the science, you know, looking at and locating the stars, and then the astrology gave them meaning. So after, you know, the Middle Ages and the Illumination period and science coming up, that's when those sciences were severed from each other. And psychology, if, you know, look at the science, scientific world is kind of a science, but it's also an art.
Mm-hmm, yes.
We that are in the field, we know that. There are techniques, and there are evidence-based techniques, and there's a lot of research, but there's a big, big part, which is the relationship between the therapist and the client that mm-hmm. plays a big, big role.
Yes.
So astrology and psychology work very well together for me, I believe, because the astrology gives me the opportunity to have an assessment, an in-depth assessment, very quickly. Where usually if we would use a traditional psychology assessment that we do, it can take more than one session. And the client can tell us what they want to tell us, especially those clients that, you know, don't want to be in treatment.
So definitely. When
you start from, you know, with the astrology, using it as an assessment tool, the astrologer talks. And clients are just amazed. They're just like, wow. I mean, I just was seeing a client the other day for therapy and real briefly used the chart. It wasn't even a long session. And I just pointed them some points on the chart and told, and I'd never seen that person before. And he looked at me and he said, oh my God, how long do you know me? And that causes in the client, number one, it's going to be hard for me here to lie because she kind of sees a lot in there. And number two, there's a level of trust that gets created that is very, very fast, much faster than if we just do the traditional psychological in-depth interview.
Yeah, from that perspective, that's interesting on its own because it's like you're doing background information on them. You're pulling up the chart and you're telling them this is what I see. And, yeah. You know, they can say yes or they can say no, but they can, you know, like you said, you've had it with many clients where they're amazed that it's like, I can't believe that you found that information on me. And mm-hmm. that almost gives them permission to maybe open up a little bit more because you've got background information on them somewhat. So
that's right.
It's probably a little more of an icebreaker versus some people. Well, a lot of people when they come into therapy initially, they're scared or they just don't know what's happening. I mean, if it's their very first counseling session, it's you know, breaking the ice. It's letting that person warm up to you, and it's like you said, it's the rapport setting. It's
exactly
letting them get comfortable with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for a lot of people, that can be a really frightening experience. So maybe with the astrology, it's not so intimidating. Is that correct?
Yeah, that makes sense. And they get to know you because you're the one talking. So they have time to, especially those clients that are wary and, you know, first time, as you mentioned, they get to observe you, they get to know you, they get to read you. So they have a lot of time to decide this is somebody I can trust or not, or this is somebody that triggers me the wrong way, or this is, you know, and if you do it, if you come from an empathic and understanding place, it makes it much easier to make that initial connection than if you're just sitting there with a notepad in front of you and just asking one question after the other and just taking notes. Which makes it a little bit more impersonal.
It does. The initial assessment for a lot of people can be offsetting.
Yeah.
So having that extra tool to break the ice and make a connection would probably be really helpful. What percentage of your clients overall during the years would you say does a combination?
I would say it's about 20% because right now the work I do, I've been working with the military. So I really don't present myself as an astrologer when I'm working on a military base.
Right.
So I end up just, you know, having my extra time to see those clients that are interested in having both.
So when you go back to Brazil, you're probably a rather busy woman, correct, if you're seeing clients down there?
Well, I try to make a balance because I really want to have, you know, a good time and enjoy myself and use my vacation. So I try to do a combination of not too much, still having fun, enjoying it, and not feeling stressed. But, yeah, I have. Last time I went in 2 weeks, I had 18 clients.
Wow.
So. Yeah, and that was a little much, so this time I tried to have one a day, which was okay. That worked for me, so I could have my time off, you know, see my friends and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, have balance. That's very important.
Yeah.
Especially for counselors.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about the three most important parts of a chart?
Sure. I would love to do that. When we look at a chart, there are many, many elements that we look at. The planets, 10 planets, we have 12 signs, we have the houses, the aspects. So there's many symbols that an astrologer looks at, and all these symbols have meaning. But the three big ones, the big triad, I call them, is the sun sign, that's pretty popular. Most people know their sun sign. It's easy to find. The moon sign, and that's a little harder because you really have to have somebody calculate that for you. So what is your moon sign? And then the ascendant sign. So those three, it's almost like if you're preparing a meal, those three are your basis. This is the potato and the meat and the salad. And then everything else is how are you going to prepare it? What are the toppings? What are the spices? How are you going to add to that? So I'm going to explain a little bit what each one of those means. When I do a chart, I usually look at the ascendant first, the sign of the ascendant. And technically, it means that was the sun, the sign that was ascending in the horizon when you were born. And from an astrological perspective, from a psychological perspective, it's your persona. The analogy I give my clients, I tell them if you were a house, the sign on your ascendant describes the front of your house. This is what everybody sees. This is who you are when you arrive at a party and you don't know anybody. This is what you show. The sun sign is the owner of the house. That's who's inside the house. Some people have ascendant sign and sun signs that are very similar. So these are the people that when you meet them better, you're not surprised. It's like, well, what I saw, this is who you are. People who have very different signs are those people that you're like, wow, the first impression on who you are very different. And finally, the moon sign. The moon sign represents our childhood and our emotional world. So I usually start with the ascendant, then I go to the moon sign. The moon sign describes you as a child. What have you seen? What kind of family you had? Where did you grow up? Your first environment, which is so important and impregnates us and gives us a basis to life later. And then the sun sign is our mature self, which, you know, some people mature at 12, some people never mature. But it's kind of to be your light, when you start shining, when you find your way, when you really become who you're supposed to be. So those three are a neat combination. When you just talk about those three, you can get a lot out of the chart.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's nice, because I think for a lot of people, just looking at an astrological chart can be intimidating because there can be so many symbols on it. It can be confusing. So just being able to lock into those three areas would be a good start, and especially if you don't have a lot of time to be delving into something. So I gave you my birthday and information yesterday, and what did you pull up on it?
Yes, I did pull out that your ascendant is Scorpio.
Mm-hmm.
Your moon sign is Capricorn, and your sun sign is Libra.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that?
Yes, I knew most of it, but yeah. Let's talk about it. That could be interesting.
Okay. So I'll go in the order where I usually go with clients. Okay. I start with the ascendant Scorpio. So people with Scorpio on the ascendant, so that's kind of what you present to the world. That's the first impression people have from you. And in the first moment, they tend to be reserved, kind of suspicious. So if you would arrive at that party where you don't know people, the tendency with an ascendant Scorpio is like, I'm just going to look around, see who's who, what kind of party that is, what's happening, kind of get a good feel, and kind of does not approach people right away and really doesn't like to be approached right away, prefer to do that first scan, so to say.
Scope it out.
Somebody, What?
I scope it out.
You scope it out. And once somebody with the Scorpio ascendant feels like, okay, I can trust, this is okay, then they actually look for a very intense contact. That's why the scoping out happens, because they really want to find somebody or a situation that really moves them. It's a very intense, emotionally intense sign. So they're not happy with 80. They want 8 or 800. So they're looking for somebody that really moves them to the core. They want to have a conversation that's intense, or an experience that's intense. For some people, it's difficult. Like, maybe, I don't know if you had that experience, some people might feel put off by people with Scorpio ascendant, because you'll be the one that will be asking very penetrating questions at that soiree where people are holding their cocktail, and they might feel like, whoa, you know, this is, and you're just, you know, this is, I'm interested in interesting conversations. I'm not, mm-hmm. you're not typically your people who will do the small talk and talk about the weather. That doesn't move them at all.
And that's how I ended up getting this show.
There you go. That's great. When we learn to use, when we use our energy in the right place, that's, you know, that's perfect. Mm-hmm. Scorpio on the ascendant, they also have a lot of energy. They're the ones that when everybody else is like, oh, I'm done, I'm falling apart, they're still there. They're holding. So you want somebody with a strong Scorpio energy. If there's a crisis or an emergency or things, the Scorpio people are the ones that are going to say, you know, there's a joke in astrology that we say that the Scorpio people are the ones that decide when they're going to die.
That's great. I'll remember that. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm not ready yet.
You're not ready yet. That's good. That's good. So they like those situations that are intense. So yes. Some people might feel a little like, oh, this is a little too strong to me. Mm-hmm. Now, in your case, then we go over to the Moon in Capricorn. Moon in Capricorn, we call that as an it's a moon exile. Moon is at home in Cancer, which is opposite to Capricorn. So if a planet is opposite to sign, we call it, it's an exile. So it means like, it's not really very comfy there. So Moon in Capricorn children are children who had to grow fast or who had a lot of responsibilities placed on them very early on. Either they're the oldest or the only, or parents weren't really around. So these are the kids that very early on expressed the sense of responsibility and seemed very disciplined, and they do the right thing, and then automatically the grown-ups around say, oh, you can let, you know, Julianne handle it. And they're kind of serious small adults. They want to manage life well. They want to improve. They're kind of the people who save today to have later. If you think of Capricorn, a good analogy is the goat that was on a mountain. Mm-hmm. So they're very, very self-sufficient. They don't need a lot. They're just climbing the mountain. And it's usually a good sign to have as a mature adult. As a child, it can have a lot of heaviness because it's not a sign that allows for a good flow of emotions. As a child, if you have the moon in Capricorn, there might have been situations where it was just not appropriate or not valued to show emotion. It was valued to show hard work and responsibility.
Especially growing up in a German household.
I can relate to that.
I know you can.
Totally. Yeah, Germans are very Capricorn in nature. Like, the energy of Germany is very Capricorn in nature.
Interesting.
So then we go into the sun sign, and it's like when you grew up, you became a Libra. So you went from a Capricorn. So for people listening out there, that's kind of how you look at it. The ascendant is what I show. The moon sign is who I was in my childhood or the energy that was around me. And then the sun sign is when I kind of who I am when I grew up. And the Libra is sign. I mean, it's the if you look at the scale, you know, you have it's a sign that ponders, that looks for balance, looks for harmony, doesn't like to be alone very much, because it's very important to have somebody kind of on the other side that tells me how am I doing. They like that mirroring. So in a way, it's a lighter sign coming from that Capricorn energy. Libra is an air sign, likes to relate to people, loves the world of art, yes. Like the art feeds their sense of harmony and their sense of good taste. They have a very strong sense of justice. They can put their own emotions aside just to, you know, be fair to a person or a situation. So it's an easier sign to live with, being a Libra.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense, and that kind of ties into one of my favorite mottos. It's never too late to have a happy childhood.
There you go.
I'm living it now. And that all makes sense from what you just told me. So thank you so much for doing that interpretation. We are going to take a small break here, and then we're going to wrap things up, and you can let everybody know how to contact you. And
sure.
Anything else you want to mention towards the end, that would be excellent. Thank you so much.
Are you searching for answers and insight to life issues? Is the behavior of family or friends questionable or concerning? Find tips and possible solutions from the convenience of your own PC, cell phone, or tablet at therapycable.com. Therapy Cable has the most comprehensive library of contemporary therapy videos online. Help may be as easy as a few clicks away. Therapy Cable offers comprehensive therapy videos ranging from addiction to self-care and contact information for qualified providers. Find the answers to your life challenges at therapycable.com.
Psych One-on-One with Julianne Good and Ileana Herdani from El Paso, Texas. And we were talking about combining psychology and astrology. And thank you, Ileana, for that mini reading. That was pretty fascinating. I got to say, I was just, you know.
That's great. You're welcome.
Yeah, I was a little blown away by it. I was like, going, wow. I mean, you know, I think you really pinpointed some really deep aspects about me, which I'm not going to share, but it is interesting. Because of course, when you read astrology in magazines or the newspaper or whatever, they're so general. They're more like for, light, fluffy entertainment versus getting in and actually doing the charts. So,
yeah. And I wanted to add that here's where the misconception in astrology happens many times. Is probably as I was telling you those points, in your mind's eye, you were probably having, flashbacks, memories, images come up. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people then kind of, there's almost like a little moment of memory lapse or something where later on people say, oh my God, the astrologer described my dad or whoever precisely. And it's because in that moment, the client is visualizing the scene and I'm describing the energy, and they just put it together, and they kind of mix it. And I don't know the stories. I don't know how you're growing. I wasn't there. But that's kind of what happened. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And you're right. I was actually visualizing, especially when you're talking about Moon in Capricorn and that goat trudging up that mountain. And having all that responsibility, that was very right. Fitting for my childhood. So that was really interesting, just pinpointing that.
Yeah, and you can see how a client would then feel comfortable. It's like, oh, wow, she knows that. So a client would feel, it would be easier for a client to open up and bring out some issues or some stories or some things they want to talk about more in depth.
Right, especially if it's something deep and as you had stated before, it's a lot of clients come in and say, I've never told anybody this before, which, yeah. You know, as counselors, we do get that statement up quite a bit or some form of that. So to have right. that comfort set up for them almost right off the bat is it probably knocks down a few of the therapy sessions because they're ready and willing to share and open up.
Exactly, yeah.
So what is the most pressing issue that you have dealt with working with both of these combined, with both astrology and the psychology? Like you've looked at somebody's chart and go, oh my God, how am I going to tell them this? Or how am I going to work with this particular aspect that came up in the chart?
I think the most difficult and pressing issues are childhood traumas. So I'm not able to define the trauma per se, as I was just explaining. But I can see on the chart that there's a lot of aspects and points that point to a very difficult childhood. And I don't know where that client is in terms of opening up, ready to look at it, how much trauma happened. So when I see that in a chart, I tread very lightly.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of start, I scratch the surface, and then I observe. I use a lot of my nonverbal observational skills and look at the client and try to see how the client is reacting, what they're doing emotionally. Are they starting to cry profusely? So then I define of how much deeper I'll go or not. And even check in, with the client. How are you doing? Are you doing okay? And wait for that feedback to see how much deeper I can go. And if I feel that the client is just not ready, doesn't want to, or is just too emotionally moved by that, I kind of leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that there's more. I just don't go there because I feel the client is just not ready. And I leave the door open. And I say, whenever you want to talk more about any aspect that I talked about on the chart, just let me know. And I'll be glad to go in more depth.
Yeah, so you're mindful of bringing things up in a light
yeah.
way. That's great. I love that. So, yeah. Ileana, if anybody wants to contact you, how can they do so?
contact me through my website. I have two websites. One is called lifeaspects.com, and that's my kind of counselor website. And the other is the astroaspects.com, and this is my astrology website. So either one of those are a great place to reach me.
Terrific. Thank you so much for being my guest, Eliana.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And thank you for joining me on Psych One-on-One. I appreciate you listening in. I hope you have a lovely week and open yourself up. Take the journey. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Bye now.